Hello, welcome to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, March 27th, 2025. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We begin the second hour by reading the obituaries. Today's list includes just two names. Virginia Piper, known as Ginny, 89, of Tempe, and Catherine Whitlow, known as Kitty, 71, of Phoenix. Sun Sounds of Arizona extends its condolences to the families and friends of the individuals listed in today's obituaries. And now we'll turn to the business section of the paper. Looks like there's three articles here. Just two articles, but they're fairly big. First one is more local. Arizona Attorney General warns users about 23andMe data. This was an article written by Karen Bartunek for the Arizona Republic. In light of 23andMe's recent bankruptcy filing, Attorney General Chris Mays urged Arizonans to invoke their rights under Arizona law to demand deletion of their genetic data. The direct-to-consumer genetic testing and information company, 23andMe, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy on March 23rd, leaving questions about what will happen to the genetic information that was amassed in its databases. Mays warned Arizona residents in a news release that the company may be selling their genetic data and private information as part of their bankruptcy proceedings. In a news release, 23andMe stated that despite the bankruptcy, quote, the company intends to continue operating its business in the ordinary course throughout the sale process. There are no changes to the way the company stores, manages, or protects customer data, unquote. But yet, according to the company's privacy statements, that might not be enough. In an article published in March in the New England Journal of Medicine, three law professors expressed concerns that existing protections may not suffice, and they called on Congress to do more to shield consumer data from such corporate changes. The authors wrote, describing the issue as a structural problem in a legal system relying heavily on privacy policies to protect consumer data while also treating those data as a valuable asset. They wrote this, quote, if 23andMe goes bankrupt, these data will most likely be sold to the highest bidder, a successor company that customers might not want to entrust with their genetic data, unquote. The company's consumer agreements offer little comfort, the authors said, because the company reserves the right to transfer customer data in case of sale or bankruptcy, and customers can't fully protect their data from being, quote, accessed, sold, or transferred as part of that transaction, unquote. Well, according to Arizona law, consumers can request that data be permanently deleted. Mays said, quote, Arizona law allows consumers to take control of their genetic data and request that a company delete it. Because of 23andMe's current financial situation, I urge Arizonans to consider invoking their rights under Arizona law and request a deletion of genetic data held by 23andMe, unquote. Arizona's Genetic Information Privacy Act, which was House Bill 2069, became effective back on September 29, 2021, mandating that direct-to-consumer genetic testing companies adhere to specific consent requirements and privacy policies. Included under the Arizona Genetic Information Privacy Act is the right to delete the consumer's account and genetic data, as well as the right to request and obtain the destruction of the consumer's biological sample. Now, there's different data that 23andMe users can download from their profiles, including genetic information, like registration and web behavior information and self-reported information, according to USA Today. So here are the different types of data. There is the report's summary, a brief description of all 23andMe report results, the ancestry composition raw data, genomic coordinates for ancestry composition results in CSV format. Then there's the DNA relatives data, shared DNA segments and profile data for DNA relatives in CSV format. Then there's the raw data, genetic data in its raw, uninterpreted format, AS, TS, GS, and CS in text format. Then there's registration and web behavior, the account event history, the mailing address associated with the account, the legal document, gift cards received from 23andMe, changes made to profile name or order or history or shared reports. Then there's phenotype data. That's data provided through research participation and or 23andMe profile. So how do we delete our genetic data from 23andMe? Number one, you log in to your 23andMe account on their website. Number two, you go to their settings section of your profile. Number three, you scroll down to a section labeled 23andMe data at the bottom of the page. And then number four, click View next to the 23andMe data. Then number five, download your data. If you want a copy of your genetic data for personal storage, choose the option to download it to your device before proceeding. Step 6, scroll down to the Delete Data section. Number 7, click Permanently Delete Data. Number 8, confirm your request. That's when you will receive an email from 23andMe, and then follow the link in the email to confirm your deletion request. If you previously opted to have your saliva sample and DNA stored by 23andMe, but want to change that preference, you can do so from your account settings page under the Preferences menu. Now, how to revoke permission for your genetic data to be used for research? If you previously consented to 23andMe and third-party researchers using your genetic data and sample for research, you may withdraw consent from the Account Settings page under the menu item Research and Product Consents. And that was the article, Arizona Attorney General Warns Users About 23andMe Data. The second article from the business section, Stagflation Worries on Radar for U.S. Economy. Now, this article was written by Howard Schneider for the Reuters News Group out of Washington. Recent economic projections from Federal Reserve officials had shades of stagflation light in the words of one economist, a sentiment increasingly echoed among other observers of the U.S. economy and central bank wondering if the country's outperformance during the pandemic is about to slide. So what is stagflation, and why is it suddenly on everyone's mind? Stagflation is a period of both high inflation and high joblessness. It hit the U.S. notably in the 1970s, which may have featured the worst U.S. economic leadership since the Great Depression. Fed officials had their data and their framework wrong, and elected officials flailed against inflation with price controls, and what now seems quaint public relations efforts, most notoriously the Ford administration's Whip Inflation Now button campaign. As economists in recent weeks have begun marking down their estimates of economic growth and marking up their estimates of inflation in the face of dramatic economic policy shifts under President Donald Trump, it has sparked debate about whether that could be unfolding again now. In theory, a weak economy with rising unemployment undercuts inflation, so the two should not coexist. But as with the oil price shocks in the 1970s that drove prices higher, the tariff shock anticipated from Trump's trade policies now has the world guessing. Trump administration officials say the tariffs are part of what they bill as a transition for the economy that, coupled with the other efforts to deregulate industry and cut taxes, will produce both plentiful jobs and lower inflation. Well, the hints of stagflation in current forecast aren't nearly as bad as back in the 1970s, which was a decade in a league of its own when a surge in the so-called misery index combining the unemployment and inflation rate, still stands out in charts of post-war economy. But the direction of travel for major aspects of the economy has caught economists' attention. When Fed officials recently assessed the risk they see ahead, they pointed uniformly toward higher inflation and higher unemployment than previously expected. Stagflation light is what RSM chief economist Joe Brusselas titled his analysis of the Fed's meeting last week. Policymakers' forecast, quote, implied mild stagflation ahead in the near term as growth slows and inflation increases. He noted the pervasive uncertainty around the size and magnitude of the trade shock, unquote. Well, Fed policymakers last week left interest rates unchanged, but still anticipate 2 quarter-point cuts by year-end. Their new economic projections, however, laid bare their conundrum. Growth is anticipated to slow, unemployment to rise a bit more than expected, and inflation to accelerate in the face of widening tariffs. Implied by their forecast of cuts and higher inflation is a belief that tariff-triggered price hikes would be one-off jumps, the same assumption that the FUD made early in the pandemic when it called rising prices transitory and were then proven wrong. Things are different now. Factories and ports are open. Goods are flowing. But given the scope and breadth of what Trump is planning, officials say the outcome remains unpredictable. Hard macroeconomic data, as Fed Chair Jerome Powell noted in his news conference last week, remains solid. Quote, the misery index is rather low, but the softer measures, like sentiment, are sliding, which is something that policymakers feel could cause businesses to stall investment and hiring, and households to cut back, even as tariffs lead prices to keep rising. Fed officials note growing concern among business contacts and have begun discussing the difficult choice moments of stagflation poses for a central bank tasked with controlling inflation while sustaining employment. Chicago Fed President Austin Goolsbee said last week on CNBC, quote, "There is nothing more uncomfortable than the stagflationary environment, where both sides of the mandate start going wrong. There is not a generic answer. Which is worse? Is it bigger on the inflation side? Is it bigger on the job market side? Higher tariffs raise prices and reduce output, so that is a stagflationary impulse," unquote. Now, if the Fed is caught in the middle, its priority is clear: to ensure that not just inflation, but public expectations about inflation remain under control. Perhaps the key mistake of the 1970s was a failure to understand better the role that public psychology plays in future inflation. Scarred by rising prices, Americans' belief that cost would keep on rising kept pushing prices higher, even as the economy weakened. It took punishing interest rates and 2 successive recessions under Fed Chief Paul Volcker to begin to establish the Fed's credibility and reset expectations through the rest of the 1980s and into the 1990s. And that is a lesson that Powell has said he takes to heart, and one he says he won't repeat. At his news conference after the Fed's most recent meeting, Powell said, quote, "I don't see any reason to think that we're looking at a replay of the 70s or anything like that. Underlying inflation is still running in the 2s, with probably a little bit of a pickup associated with tariffs. I would not say we're in a situation that is remotely comparable to that," unquote. But then he went on and said, "But stable inflation expectations are at the very heart of our framework. We will be watching all of it very, very carefully. We do not take anything for granted." And that was the article, "Stagflation Worries on Radar for U.S. economy. And those were the two articles from the business section of the paper. At 15 minutes past the hour, we're going to move on over to the sports section now. On the front page of the sports section, there's a big picture of a Diamondbacks game. A couple of Diamondbacks players high-fiving, it looks like at the home plate. But underneath that picture, it says, Dare to Dream, D-backs opening day. And the subtitle is, Five Big Questions the D-backs Need to Answer This Season. This article was written by Nick Pecoro for the Arizona Republic. The thing about a baseball season is that no matter how much we think we know about what might happen, we rarely have any clue exactly how things are going to transpire. And that's part of what makes it so fun. And so as the Diamondbacks embark on another year with high expectations, let's take a look at what we think might be important, knowing full well the year will surprise us many, many times along the way. Number one, can Burns lead a rotation bounce back? The Diamondbacks had the fourth worst rotation by ERA in the majors last season. They were battered by injuries, but they also had several pitchers underperform. Obviously, adding a legitimate ace like Corbin Burns to the mix should do wonders, but the group has other questions as well. Can Merrill Kelly and Eduardo Rodriguez stay healthy? Can Zach Gallen get back to his Cy Young caliber form? Is Brandon Pfaadt ready to take a step forward? If there was one area to point to as why the Diamondbacks missed the playoffs last year, it was probably the rotation. Number two, which version of outfielder Carroll will the Diamondbacks get? The Diamondbacks led the majors in runs scored last year, and they somehow managed to do it with star outfielder Corbin Carroll turning in just an okay season. The good news for the Diamondbacks is that during spring training, Carroll looked like his 2023 self. He was lacing balls hard all over the field and taking extra bases with his usual aplomb. If that's the version of Carroll the Diamondbacks get this year, it will make their offense that much more intimidating. Number three, is Puck or Martinez ready to emerge as a dominant closer? General manager Mike Hazen wanted to add a proven closer to his bullpen this winter. He tried. He inquired on trading for Devin Williams and Emmanuel Clase and Ryan Helsley, and engaged in conversations with free agent Kirby Yates, but ultimately could not close a deal. But just because the Diamondbacks don't have a reliever with a proven track record in the ninth inning doesn't mean they don't have someone or multiple someones who can do the job well. Lefty A.J. Puke, that's P-U-K is his last name, might have been the most dominant reliever in baseball the second half of last year. And right-hander Justin Martinez might have the best pure stuff of anybody in the majors. Manager Torey Lovullo hasn't named a closer, but whichever way he goes, the possibility exists that the Diamondbacks already have the right man for the job. Whoever it is will just have to prove that he can handle it. Number four, can the Diamondbacks replace the run producers Walker and Pettersson? Both Christian Walker and Jock Pettersson played key roles in the middle of the lineup last year, and both departed as free agents in December. It is easier to assume what the Diamondbacks will be getting in Walker's replacement. Josh Naylor, whom they acquired from the Cleveland Guardians, is a proven run producer. But it stands to reason he won't live up to Walker's defensive prowess. As for Pettersson's replacement, there are more unknowns when it comes to Pavin Smith. Last season, Smith seemed to come into his own as a hitter at the major league level, marrying his elite plate discipline skills with the legitimate power he showed in spurts in the past. The question will be if he can prove that emergence was real. And number five, if they aren't better than the Dodgers, Are they at least better than enough other teams in the National League? It won't be easy for the Diamondbacks to advance to October via a division title, not when they share the NL West with the Dodgers, who possess one of the best rosters anyone can remember. The question more likely will be, can the Diamondbacks finish in the top three of a large swath of teams that will likely include the Mets, the Braves, the Brewers, the Padres, and the Giants? That's assuming the Phillies and the Cubs, which are favorites in their divisions, win the NL East and Central, respectively. Last year, the Diamondbacks fell one shy of a wild card spot. Playing in the NL West feels like a distinct disadvantage. Not only are they unlikely to win the division, they have to face the Dodgers 13 times and face the Padres and the Giants 13 times apiece. That's a quarter of their schedule against teams that look tough on paper. That's a tougher task than clubs in the East or Central. And that was Nick Pecoro's article, Dare to Dream. Our next article is about March Madness and college men's basketball. Written by Bruce Pascoe for the Arizona Daily Star, it's entitled Duke Stands in Way of Sweet 16 Breakthrough for Cats. The chance for Tommy Lloyd to reach a new postseason ceiling will intersect with arguably the most disliked opponent in Arizona Wildcats history on March 27th. Now maybe that's fitting. Top-ranked and top-seeded Duke in the Sweet 16. The cross-country rival that has produced six drama-filled games during the Lute Olson era, including Arizona's loss in the 2001 National Championship game. Well, it's back again. Duke was also the team that Arizona and star forward Derek Williams unforgettably swatted away in the 2011 Sweet 16, and the team that provided a memorable two-year series that finished earlier this season. Arizona beat Duke at its renowned Cameron Indoor Stadium last season, but then lost to the Blue Devils at McHale earlier this season. That Duke is expected to win again this time makes this Sweet 16 somewhat different for Lloyd, who is the Wildcats' fourth-year coach. In 2022, Lloyd led Arizona to a number one seed, but Houston upset the Wildcats 72-60 in a Sweet 16 game that didn't appear even that close. Last season, the second-seeded Wildcats lost to the number 6th seed Clemson 77-72 while shooting just 37% from the field. A similar result on Thursday would not be a surprise. VegasInsider.com, the website, posted an opening line with Duke favored by 8.5 points. But enough money flowed in on Duke that the U of A bettors were getting 9.5 on Tuesday. Everything that about this season suggests the Wildcats should be underdogs as well. Well before they ascended to the number one ranking and number two overall NCAA tournament seed behind only Auburn, the Blue Devils rolled into McHale Center on November 22nd with little trouble. In what was just the fifth ever college game for its three standout freshmen, Duke Len all but ignored a rowdy sellout crowd and several U of A basketball dignitaries sitting courtside en route to their 69-55 win over the Wildcats. Because in that game, Arizona shot just 39% from the field. They made it to the free throw line only 11 times, and they were out-rebounded 43-30. Duke hit 9 of 25 three-pointers and scored 14 second-chance points off 13 offensive rebounds. The Blue Devils took a 7-point halftime lead and led U of A throughout the second half. Guard Caleb Love, who was 1 of 9 from three-point range in that game, said, quote, "We didn't shoot the ball well. We put ourselves in position to win the game multiple times, and they just made more plays than us," unquote. The Wildcats' 55 points tied the lowest they had ever scored under Lloyd at that point, and they went on to score just 54 twice later this season. That was in losses to UCLA in Phoenix on December 14th, and at Texas Tech on January 18th. But in between those 54-point efforts, the Wildcats turned their season around. Center Montius Krivas watched the UCLA game in a boot after playing in the first 8 games of the season, and when he was ruled out for the rest of the season later in the month because of a foot-ankle injury, that allowed the Wildcats to shape their talent into a more cohesive 8-player rotation. They improved on both ends of the court, now ranking 28th in defensive efficiency and 13th in offensive efficiency. Lloyd said, quote, "I think we found more of an identity. Early in the season, we obviously struggled to find our identity and the roles people were going to play for us to be successful. We've dug a little deeper on that and definitely have a little more certainty in that area," unquote. Arizona finished non-conference play, shooting just 30% from three-point range, while assisting made baskets 56% of the time. But against the consistently stiffer Big 12 defenses, the Wildcats shot 32% from three-point range, and its range of assist to made baskets grew to 59.6. Love said, quote, "We were such a different team early on. We're much better. We're so much more connected on both ends of the floor. Our offense has changed, and our defense has taken a jump," unquote. But Duke has accomplished all of that as well. The Blue Devils sandwiched wins over Wofford and Arizona with losses to Kentucky and Kansas, but have lost only one since then, and that was a road conference game at Clemson on February 8th. All right, this is going to be Thursday's game. Number 4th-ranked Arizona versus number 1st-ranked Duke. It will be at 6:39 p.m. on CBS TV. And that was the article, "Duke Stands in Way of Sweet 16 Breakthrough for Cats." Our next article is also about D-backs opening day. This is written by Greg Moore, columnist for the Arizona Republic. It's entitled, "D-backs Gallon Opening Day. It's a Dream Come True." Zach Gallon is ready to take the mound as Arizona's opening day starter, giving us a chance to peer into the Diamondbacks' future. You don't need a crystal ball or a Ouija board or some pagan cult ritual that risk casting your soul into eternal damnation. All you need is a little imagination and a dose of optimism. Gallon could end up being the most popular player in franchise history. And at 7:10 p.m. on March 27th at Chase Field in downtown Phoenix, it could be the moment we all look back on as the moment we all knew it was real. Gallon said in the clubhouse a couple of days before the 2025 season opener, quote, "It's definitely an honor. It's not something I ever even dreamed of as a kid," unquote. Well, it's his third time in a row getting the start, and the excitement hasn't diminished a bit. He said, quote, "The honor has kept getting cooler the further I've gone in my career. I'm grateful that Torre Lavulo gave me the honor. We had a lot of good, solid choices that he could have picked from," unquote. Now, the best of those options, of course, is Corbin Burns. The former Cy Young winner is as good as anybody in baseball, and his signing was widely considered one of the biggest moves of the offseason. Burns is capable, certainly, but Gallon has earned the trust of the organization and, more importantly, the fan base. He's the guy who led the most improbable World Series run in recent memory in 2023, and he helped keep the Diamondbacks in contention deep into last season. Gallon, with his signature glasses and his physics-defying knuckle curve, is one NL West title over the hated Dodgers, one Cy Young Award, one World Series championship away from becoming the most beloved Diamondback ever, especially if he stays here for the rest of his career. If that's too big of a dream for you, how about imagining Gallon taking a huge step toward becoming the Diamondbacks' version of Diana Taurasi, or Larry Fitzgerald, or Shane Doan, or Devin Booker? Manager Tori Lavulo said, quote, "That's a big responsibility, and Zach doesn't take that lightly. I'm very proud of him for that," unquote. And his opinion matters. Lavulo has the longest tenure of any manager in franchise history, and he is one of the longest tenured skippers in Major League Baseball. He said, quote, "Zach takes this job seriously the minute he walks into this ballpark. But there's a different side of Zach that I think fans are going to get to see. He's extremely easy to connect with. He's great inside of the clubhouse. But I think externally, he's out in the community. He's giving everybody a chance to get to know him. That's the part of Zach that I love," unquote. Well, of course, none of that would matter if the guy couldn't pitch. Gallen has finished as high as third in Cy Young voting for the National League's best pitcher. He's been an all-star starter. He puts up stats that make sabermetricians click their calculators. But he also puts up numbers that all of us old baseball card guys love, like wins. He had 14 of them last year when he missed time and scrapped along with nagging injuries. You know, as long as we're being imaginative and optimistic, which is what opening day is all about, how about we imagine Gallen getting better? Lavulo said, quote, "He wants to just go out there and be the best version of himself, constantly learning, constantly growing, constantly gathering information. He's a perfectionist, and he wants to be as good as he can possibly be. I think he's motivated overall to be elite. That's how he's wired. I'm anxious to see what type of year he has," unquote. Gallen has said much of the same. He wants to finish the job he started a couple of years ago and help deliver a championship to the fans in Arizona. Gallen said, quote, "I feel like I have a little bit more to prove this year. I have a little bit of a chip on my shoulder coming from the end of 23 and last year to prove to people that I still can do some things in this game," unquote. Well, that all starts on opening day against the Cubs, who are never an easy assignment with so many Chicago transplants living in the Phoenix area. But if Gallen goes out and shuts them down, maybe this year, when a lot of those Cub fans who can still hear Harry Carey singing "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" will finally start rooting for the D-backs. Maybe this is the start of something bigger that we can hope or imagine. And if that sounds like a big dream, I get it. But isn't that what this is all about? It's opening day. Dream now, or don't dream at all. But we could look back on this as the moment when we all knew it was real. And that's Thursday's game, the D-backs versus the Cub, on dbacks.tv at 7:30 p.m. And that was the article, D-backs Gallen Opening Day, It's a Dream Come True. Well, we finished the front page of the sports section. It's time to turn the page and look at some of the articles inside the sports section. Hey, here's one about men's basketball. Durant on fire as Suns look to extend the streak, by Dwayne Rankin for the Arizona Republic. Phoenix Suns superstar Kevin Durant is showing once again why he is an all-time great and remains one of the game's best players at age 36. Just check the numbers and wins to go along with them. Durant has averaged 35.3 points on 55.3% shooting, 6 rebounds, 7 assists, and 1.3 blocks in Phoenix's 3 games prior to Wednesday's home game against Boston. All of those ended in victories, with the latter two coming against the NBA East leader Cleveland and playoff-bound Milwaukee. Suns forward Royce O'Neal said, quote, "It's special. He's doing a great job of leading us, knocking down big shots, creating opportunities for other guys as well. He gets so much attention on the offensive end that guys are going to be open. He's playing the right way, getting to his spots and knocking them down," unquote. The Suns, whose record is 35-37 entering Wednesday night's game, are playing perhaps their best basketball with Durant leading the way. They'll likely need another special performance from him Wednesday against the defending NBA champion Boston Celtics at PHX Arena to conclude their five-game homestand. Recently named Western Conference Player of the Week, Durant wasn't focused on continuing to have a heater against the Celtics. Durant said after Wednesday morning's shoot-around, quote, "I just go out there and play and just let the game flow how it flows. That's how it's been flowing the last couple of games. I've got to be prepared for any situation. I might not put up a lot of shots some games, or it might not call for that. So I just got to keep playing, find ways to be effective, making my teammates' life easier as well. Just play the game. I don't think too much about the end result," unquote. The Suns have been one of the NBA's worst defensive teams this season, as they are 26th in defensive rating on the season. They're playing much better on that end as of late. Phoenix is 11th in defensive rating during the four-game win streak. O'Neal said, quote, "Bring in a lot of intensity, flying around, trying to force turnovers, guys just rotating for each other, us talking and being more connected," unquote. The defensive improvement has enabled the Suns to play through some rough offensive patches and turnovers to remain in the games. They were able to defeat the Bucks 108-106, despite committing 16 turnovers that led to 27 Milwaukee points. Devin Booker hit the game winner with 2.4 seconds left. He's one of the game's best players, but his playmaker ability has been on full display in recent games. Booker is averaging 24.1 points and 9.8 assists in his last six games. Durant said, quote, "He's seeing the floor at an all-time rate. The game is slowing down. He's seeing stuff before it opens up," unquote. Now the Suns are still without Bradley Beal, who missed his fifth straight game Wednesday with a left hamstring strain, but they're looking to stay hot in pursuit of a play-in spot. Booker said after Monday's win, quote, "We put ourselves in this situation, so it feels like the playoffs already. We've got to have every game," unquote. Phoenix was a 10th seed, holding the final play-in spot at the Western Conference on Wednesday, but it had the same record as the 9th-seeded Sacramento heading into the Celtics game. If the Suns beat the Kings in their final regular season on April 13th in Sacramento, it will even the season series at 2-2. If both teams have the same record at season's end, Phoenix will win the tiebreaker because it will have a better record in the Pacific Division than the Kings. They each have two games left in the Pacific Division. The Suns are 9-5 in the division, while the Kings have a 4-10 record in the division. And that was the article, Durant on Fire as Suns Look to Extend Streak. Okay, I think we have time for some sports briefs. These are three short little articles. And then there's no author associated with the articles. The first one is Mississippi State Player Target of Online Hate. The Mississippi State women's basketball player, who was involved in the play that ended with Southern Cal superstar guard Juju Watkins getting injured, has been the subject of hateful comments on social media. The Bulldogs lost Monday to the Trojans in the second round of the NCAA tournament. But the bigger story was Watkins' injury. Mississippi State Chandler Prater was guarding Watkins as the National Player of the Year candidate was driving to the basket and made contact with her. Watkins' right knee buckled, and she fell to the court in pain. She was carried off the court, and it was later revealed she would need surgery and miss the rest of the season. Mississippi State coach Sam Purcell said after the 96-59 loss that he was praying for Watkins, adding she was special and means a lot for women's basketball. He said, quote, "We're a program of class, and my prayers and thoughts are with Juju. We don't play to hurt. We play to compete. There was no harm. I pray as a society we understand that we don't take this further than it needs to," unquote. But Purcell's comments did not stop the online hate for Prater, who played for Oklahoma State and Kansas before spending her final season with Mississippi State. Prater's most recent social posts have had the comments turned off, but comments have been posted on her older post, and some of them called her a dirty player. Then we have reports say that wide receiver Diggs agrees to a deal with Patriots. Stephon Diggs and the New England Patriots have agreed on a 3-year, $69 million contract, according to reports. The four-time Pro Bowler's new deal includes $26 million guaranteed, according to the reports. Diggs, who is 31, spent the 2024 season with the Texans after arriving in Houston from the Bills via trade. As part of the trade, the Texans voided the final 3 years of Diggs' contract so that he would become a free agent after 1 year with the team. The veteran wideout played in 8 games for the Texans before an ACL tear in Week 8 ended his season early. Diggs finished 2024 with 47 catches for 496 yards and 3 touchdowns. Prior to the 2024 season, Diggs had put together 6 straight seasons with more than 1,000 receiving yards, 2 with the Vikings and 4 with the Bills. And the third one is Boston NWSL expansion team unveils nickname again. Goodbye, Boss Nation FC. Hello, Boston Legacy FC. 5 months after introducing a widely panned name and marketing slogan, the officials of Boston's National Women's Soccer League Expansion Club revealed their new name. The first name, Boss Nation, B-O-S Nation, was an anagram of the term Bostonian. Its slogan was Too Many Balls. It was intended to relay the need for more women's sports in the city. Well, given the immediate negativity Bostonians showed toward both, the officials quickly went back to the drawing board. The result was Boston Legacy FC. It was introduced Wednesday with a series of posts on X. The first post reads, "It's a great day to start a new legacy, to write a new chapter and build something bigger than ourselves." And those were the sports briefs. We're at 42 minutes past the hour. Time for us to read an opinion piece. I think we've got one from Lori Roberts. Her column is marked, "Diamondbacks bailout just got a lot worse." Remember when the Arizona Diamondbacks made a pitch for hundreds upon hundreds of millions of dollars in public funding to fix up their ballpark? Their plan to divert taxes generated in and around a Chase Field to pay for the upgrades? Well, that bit about how you won't pay if you don't go? Well, Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry's Danny Seedon and Representative Jeff Weninger, the sponsor of the bill to publicly fund a stadium upgrade, wrote this just a month ago. "It reinvests revenue that Chase Field is already generating. If you don't attend games, your tax dollars won't either," unquote. Well, let's beware the curveball, sports fans. The legislature and the Diamondbacks are teaming up this week to blow one right by us. Operation Fix Up This Dump that we call a ballpark now calls for Maricopa County taxpayers to kick in millions of dollars every year for 30 years. And here's a hint. It is not money generated by those D-back dogs and $15 beers sold at games. The latest version of House Bill 2704 calls for the county to match the outlay that will be required of the city of Phoenix, as possibly as much as $6.4 million a year. It's bad enough that Phoenix will have to give up sales tax revenues generated by the ballpark and whatever adjacent development the team owner builds. The county, however, has no such sales tax revenues to lose because it doesn't collect any to fund general operations. Like every other city and town in the state, it gets a sliver of state income taxes generated by the players and employees, but that's peanuts compared to what it will lose under the latest version of the bill, which was approved on March 24th by the Senate Finance Committee. That's money that now pays for the little luxuries like sheriff's deputies and prosecutors and parks and libraries. Oh, I know. It's our sacred obligation to provide the team with $500 million or possibly double that once interest is factored in to renovate the publicly owned ballpark, or we will lose the team, and the valley will become a sports wasteland, and little children will suffer because they want to be taken out to the ballgame, but alas, there won't be one. It is not enough that we, without a public vote, as I recall, built the team a place to stay. Now we're expected to rebuild the joint for the team. A team, by the way, that is now worth $1.43 billion, according to Forbes magazine. One that its bazillionaire owner Ken Kendrick bought for $238 million back in 2004. Still, it is inevitable that we're going to be on the hook. The only question is how sharp the pain will be. Well, me? I'm wondering two things. Well, three, actually. When will the team and the legislature come clean and admit that every taxpayer in Maricopa County will be paying to rebuild Chase Field? To admit that you may not attend games, but your tax dollars certainly will? Where the heck is Governor Katie Hobbs? If this bill is so all-fired important to the state's economy and reputation, and I know it is, why isn't she taking a lead role in negotiating a deal? Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego wrote to Hobbs expressing her concern about what she believes ultimately will be a $1 billion taxpayer outlay. And in reply, she has heard crickets. Nobody's talking to the county either. Maricopa County Supervisor Chairman Tom Galvin told me, quote, there has not yet been a stakeholder process that has included all of the major parties in the same room, unquote. And finally, where is the requirement that the Diamondbacks share our pain? The team assures us it plans to put up $250 million toward fixing up its broken-down ballpark. But there's nothing in the bill that mandates that. Just a legislative intent clause that appears to have no real force of law. The bill says, quote, the legislature finds that the professional baseball franchise will contribute at least $250 million of the professional baseball franchise organization's own monies for the purposes of reconstructing, equipping, repairing, maintaining, or improving the Major League Baseball facility and the adjacent buildings, unquote. Well, our leaders may find it, but curiously, they are not requiring it. And that's Diamondback's bailout just got a lot worse. And that was our opinion piece for the day. Now, we just passed 47 minutes past the hour. We're going to head on over to the entertainment section and begin with today's horoscopes. Our horoscopes begin with the sign of Aries, birth dates from March 21st to April 19th. Are you feeling drawn towards introspection? Venus, retrograding back into Pisces, removes the glimmer of the limelight. Give your relating a rest. For Taurus, birth dates from April 20th to May 20th, reconnect with your communities. You have unfinished social business to attend to. For Geminis, birth dates from May 21st to June 21st, are you reassessing your creative vision? What you are dreaming up for, your legacy, may shift. For Cancer, birth dates from June 22nd through July 22nd, relationships require a level of faith. Venus, retrograding back into Pisces, test your ability to trust in higher love. For Leo, July 23rd through September 22nd birth dates, are you revising your relational boundaries? Notice the line where you end and another begins. For you fellow Virgos out there with birth dates from August 23rd through September 22nd, a connection is on the road to recovery. Venus, retrograding back into Pisces, brings an opportunity for reconciliation. For Libras, September 23rd through October 23rd birthdates, give yourself love. After focusing intently on others, it's time to realign with self-care routines. For Scorpios, October 24th through November 21st birthdates, do you need a playful escape? You have put so much love into your work lately that it may be time to relax. For Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st birthdates, are you longing for home or family? Your emotional life benefits from love and connection. For Capricorns, December 22nd through January 19th birthdates, a love of learning may wash over you. Are you yearning to revisit a topic that's interested you from the past? For Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th birth dates, get creative with your assets. You are prompted to spend money now, so find ways to make it as well. And finally, Pisces, birth dates from February 19th to March 20th. Are you feeling the love? Welcome the sweetness. Life takes on an extra glow. And those were today's horoscopes. We turn now to letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. In her column, Dear Abby, the letter goes like this. Dear Abby, I met an acquaintance a few months ago during a brief work situation. We struck up a friendship, or so I thought, and have had lunch or dinner together a few times. She's recently divorced. She has a fancy house, lots of expensive clothes, purses, and a mega-expensive vehicle, all of which her ex paid for. I have now gotten the distinct impression that she judges me for my modest home, which I paid for myself, while putting my son through exemplary schools, all on my modest income. I don't think I'm wrong about this. It's a combination of little things, like not posting our outings on social media, as she does with other friends, for example, as well as coming around only when it suits her. At this point, I almost don't even want a relationship with her because she appears to be superficial. If and when she comes around, how should I politely decline? Or would it be wrong to state what I feel is going on? Signed, Incompatible in Texas. And Abby responds, Dear Incompatible, I can think of no polite way to tell people their values are misplaced and superficial. The woman is not likely to change them at this late date. A polite way to decline would be to tell her you are not available. If she presses you further, tell her you don't think the two of you are compatible. And P.S., before you brush her off, examine your motivation for wanting to do this. Could it be that because she has so many more material things than you, you feel self-conscious about it? I'm just asking. Our next letter goes, Dear Abby, I have been married 17 years. And we have had our ups and downs. Lately, I've noticed my husband no longer wants to go on trips together. He went on a week-long vacation with his sisters shortly after I had surgery, and he took another week-long trip to visit them and his nieces and nephews. When I spoke to him about it, his excuses ranged from, it will be too crowded, or it's too much money. This morning, I put my foot down. I said I'm going away for a weekend trip, and he can come with me or stay behind. He got upset. I work from home, long hours, and I haven't had a break in close to a year. I'm starting to get fed up with his attitude and unwillingness to travel with me. Am I wrong for wanting a weekend away from home? Signed, Getting Out of Town. And Abby responds, Dear Getting Out, not in my book. You deserve to know the reason for your husband's change in attitude, which I suspect has little to do with it being too crowded. Could there be money problems that you are not aware of? If that's not the case, you and hubby need an honest conversation or two about what may be wrong. If he isn't forthcoming, it may be time to call in the help of a licensed marriage and family therapist to help you both better communicate. In the meantime, go on that trip. And those were the letters of advice written by Abigail Van Buren. And you can contact Abby in two different ways. One, you can always go to her website, www.dearabby.com, or you can write her a letter and mail it to P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, zip code 90069. I think we have time to take a look at some comics. The first one is Blondie, drawn by Dean Young and John Marshall. And in the three frames of the comic strip, Dagwood is sitting with his carpool, and he's in the front seat next to the driver. And he says, we should try taking a more scenic route to work for a change. And the driver says, great idea. Which way should we go? And in the back seat, one of the guys says, through the countryside. And then the other person said, by the water. And then Dagwood says, well, I was thinking whichever way has the most drive-throughs. And that was Blondie. And in the comic strip Baby Blues, drawn by Rick Kirkman and Jerry Scott, Mom has got her hands full of groceries, And it looks like she's coming into the house to put them away. And Hammy says, "Are crocodiles lizards?" And Mom says, "Go do some research." And the next frame, Hammy's outside on the front porch, and he says, "Hey, Kenny, are crocodiles lizards?" And a response comes from out of the frame. It says, "No, you dope." And in the last frame, Wanda says, "I meant online research." And Hammy walks by and says, "Well, I don't have to log on to Kenny." And that was Baby Blues. And in the comic strip Pickles, drawn by Brian Crane, there's Earl sitting at the table. He's eating something, and she says, "How is it?" And he goes, "Great." And then she says, "I read somewhere that by age 60, most people have lost half of their taste buds." And he looks at her and says, "Well, that's ridiculous. These mashed potatoes taste as good as ever." And she says to him in the last frame, "That's oatmeal." And that was Pickles. Well, we've got time for saying happy birthday to some celebrities. So who's celebrating today? Actor Julian Glover turns 90. Tech journalist Walt Mossberg turns 78. Keyboardist Tony Banks from the group Genesis turns 75. Actor Stephen DeLane turns 68. Singer Jan Arden turns 63. The director Quentin Tarantino turns 62. Actor Talisa Soto turns 58. Singer Mariah Carey turns 56 today. Also, actress Polly Perrette from NCIS, she turns 56 as well today. Actress Elizabeth Mitchell turns 55. Singer and actor Fergie turns 50. And actress Brenda Song turns 37. Happy birthday to all of them and congratulations. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. You have been listening to the second hour of the reading of the Arizona Republic for Thursday, March 27th, 2025. I hope you have a great day today and have a great week. Bye-bye.